Notre Dame Federal Credit Union, a mission-based financial institution that shares the common beliefs of our members and is dedicated to solving problems through extraordinary member service. Where you bank does matter.
The following is a relevant radio program and is protected under U.S. copyright laws. This program is made possible through the contributions of listeners like you. Support Relevant Radio by clicking on the donate icon at www.relevantradio.com.
As Donald Trump is about to be sworn in as president, some of his cabinet appointees are still being questioned or grilled in Senate confirmation hearings. We're learning a lot about them through those hearings, in a better way than through media spin. How are they shaping up so far? I'm Sheila Lagminas. Right now, it's 5 minutes after the hour. Time to take a closer look. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. So some media, of course, has been a lot of spin about the president-elect himself, about some of the names he threw out during the campaign before the election for Supreme Court justices if he were to be elected, and so on. And certainly about his appointees, one by one, as he made them for different cabinet posts. Media have opined on any number of those to any degree, and especially some of them more controversially than others. Well, one of the things some of the media have said is, wow, he's a little top-heavy on the generals, isn't he, or military leaders? And why so many military leaders? I've heard a lot of roundtables and panels on this in the media over the past several weeks. And is that a good thing? And some, of course, media pundits say no, and they don't like the presence of so much military might, if you will, in the cabinet of President, soon-to-be President Donald Trump. Well, joining me now is a guest who's written a very good article about that and why she believes the presence of these military leaders and veterans is a sign of strength. And that guest is Gail Trotter, an attorney and the CEO of the American Women's Alliance, whose mission is to advance issues of concern to American women who love liberty and hate tyranny. I love that. Gail, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Sheila.
It's been forever. You were here ages ago, Gail. It's been too long. We got to talk. There's an awful lot we want to catch up on because your site, GailTrotter.com, which I've linked on the show page, has a lot here. But this article really caught my attention. I want to talk about it. So the headline of this article you wrote just this week is Trump's reliance on James Mattis, military veterans, is a sign of strength. Why so, Gail?
That's right. Well, you teed it up really well because you talked about how his critics are saying that having so many veterans in his cabinet and top administrative positions is a bad choice on his part. But those same critics were also accusing him of not having military experience himself, that he never served in the military. And yet when Donald Trump decides to select these men to be in these positions, these same critics lambast him for it. Well, the truth is, think about the experience that these individuals bring to the Trump administration. They love their country. They are so patriotic, and they have basically been able to cultivate their leadership skills through the military. The military helps people from enlisted ranks all the way up to generals cultivate these leadership skills. They have to exhibit critical thinking skills during high-pressure situations in combat that none of us would really be able to relate to. And these are people that can bring these skills to an administration that has to really come to the point of being able to make up for the last 8 years of our military and our national defense being sidelined by the Obama administration.
See, these are good points, and Gail, throughout your article, you make several. So let's go through some of the excellent points. Besides the fact that they bring strength, you know, they signal strength in America again, and again, some of the more liberal media don't like that at all. You've noted that they're very worried about that, but you also say that's misplaced concern, and you point out in the article right at the top. I like this, that when it came to Marine General James Mattis taking this stand for his confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee as President-elect Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense. You say he answered the lawmakers' questions with grace and professionalism, just like the other retired military veterans tapped by the President-elect have and will. And then you say this, those who are unfamiliar with the military worry about veterans serving in civilian leadership positions, but that's misplaced because, and Gail, this is so important for people who don't understand the military well. In those of us who do, this is such a good, important point. Combat veterans, having experienced the horror of war, are less likely to send Americans unnecessarily into harm's way. And they also understand the importance of having all the military resources needed to win. But before we even get into that, back up to the grace and professionalism. We know military, and especially officer level, high officer level, military in general, are so disciplined, first of all. Second of all, they have such a sense of honor and duty and valor. That's a word a lot of people don't even know anymore. Grace, dignity. And to say that General Mattis handled himself with grace and professionalism, that right there is a characteristic. Those are characteristics of all of these veterans in the military services.
Right, and I love that word that you used, valor. That is such an excellent word to describe the character of these men that Donald Trump has selected for his cabinet and top administrative positions. And as you said, these men, some people would criticize as saying that they have this lust for war, but the truth is just the opposite. They don't want a single sailor, marine, army individual, anybody. They don't want anyone to go in this situation without resources, without a clear American interest for going into that mission. They want to have a clear mission, they want to have the resources to accomplish the mission, and they want to win. And they do not ever want to put people in these positions where they have unspeakable things happen to them. They want to protect their fellow brothers and sisters in the military. And so they, of all people, understand the sacrifice on them and on military families for the things that we ask the military to do.
Excellent point you make here and in the article. You say their career biographies record national security know-how, distinguished military service. That's important. Distinguished military service. These are going to be public servants. Years of sacrifice, duty, and a special love for the United States. Patriotism is a word that's for years now gone out of what style and vogue, and you shouldn't use it, and nationalism, right, and all that. You know, it's like political people like to use the word reset. So this is a reset, if you will, of it reflects, doesn't it, Gail, the whole election. And interestingly, in my second half of the show today, my guest is going to talk about how the media could have so spectacularly missed what was happening in this country that delivered this outcome of the election. So these cabinet nominees really signal something about this president-elect, soon-to-be president, and how he sees America's proper size and role in the world.
Right, and when you contrast that with presidents of the past, Lyndon Johnson, who wanted to personally decide on bombing targets, Jimmy Carter, who would micromanage everything coming out of the White House while he let our military decline, and clearly President Obama, who decided to remove our troops from Iraq as a strategic end unto itself without understanding what would fill the vacuum when American troops were removed. And then, of course, we had to send American troops back to Iraq and back to Afghanistan. So I think the contrast should be very fulfilling and reassuring to all Americans that Donald Trump is going to surround himself with people who understand what it takes to win and hopefully put forward this idea of peace through strength, that if we are strong, like Ronald Reagan said about a heavyweight champion, nobody insults the heavyweight champion. And instead, President Obama has made us a weakling on the world stage.
Peace through strength is something that has been reflected in the past by other presidents. You take your readers through three appointees. So let's talk about them briefly. Again, back to General Mattis. General James Mattis was nominated for Secretary of Defense, is a retired four-star Marine general who led a Marine division to Baghdad during the 2003 invasion of Iraq and more recently to the United States Command Center. John Kelly, nominated for Homeland Security, is a retired four-star Marine general whose own son was killed in combat in Afghanistan. And Michael Flynn will serve as National Security Advisor, retired Army Lieutenant General, and former Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Known for, by the way, you say, plain-spoken views on the threat of Islamic militancy. That right there, Gail, is a major shift from the current administration of the past 8 years.
Right, absolutely. We had the opposite during the Obama administration, where people were purged for having the temerity to call out radical Islamic jihadism. And through the people that he's selecting to fill these important positions, we are going to be prepared. We're not going to ignore what the enemy is who is trying to destroy America, America's values, America's ideals. And I think that is an important first step that resonated with the American voters when they decided to elect Donald Trump. And when you contrast that with this idea of, you know, calling everything extremism, but not trying to understand what is at the root of this violent behavior, that really puts our entire infrastructure of fighting terrorism at a disadvantage. So it is a refreshing approach that I think will really put us back on the path to protect the homeland and to have a new global order where hopefully some of the conflagration that we see going on in the Middle East with Christians being pushed out of their territory, their churches being burned, unspeakable things being done to Christians in these areas, hopefully we will see a reversal of this with this new administration.
Excuse me, and you know that the critics of these military generals and officers, veterans, all in the cabinet of President Donald Trump, that critics of them seem confused about whether military experience is a prerequisite
right.
or disqualification.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just carrying that 8 year at least long view of our country in, you know, vis-a-vis the world, into the next administration. And it's just completely reversing that is what it de facto is.
It is, because we have seen that approach taken by the last administration. And we have seen stuff happen that no one wants to see it happen, and it's bled over into Europe. You think of the Bataclan massacre. You think of what happened in the German Christmas market. You think about what happened on Bastille Day in Nice. And we know that we've also experienced that in the United States. We've seen it at the San Bernardino massacre. We saw it at the Pulse nightclub in Florida. And while the current administration, the outgoing administration, would like you to believe that these are all lone wolves and they're just strange outbreaks of irrational people who are extreme, that has not been sufficient to stem the tide of this threat to Americans and to peace-loving people across the world. So it is refreshing to see that there's going to be a new approach to this problem. And I think the first step is, you know, Sun Tzu said that you need to know who your enemy is.
Mm-hmm. You need to know who you, in fact, when I had Sebastian Gorka on the program and I brought that up, he also, it's a two-pronged thing. Know yourself, know who you
right.
are, and know who your enemy is. And America, in these recent years, has sort of been redefined. I mean, coming into office, the current outgoing president promised to dramatically transform, totally transform America.
Right.
So who are we today? Know yourself, Sun Tzu said in The Art of War, and know your enemy. And that's important. This is a really good article. My guest, Gail Trotter, posted this fine article, Trump's Reliance on James Mattis, Military Veterans, Other Military Veterans, is a Sign of Strength. And she explains, takes you through it, why. Her website also has several other articles on it, a lot of information she's got here about healthcare, about Trump's tax plan. plan about America to be globally competitive again. Gail's a columnist, political analyst, and attorney who regularly appears on TV, Fox News channels, different shows there you're used to. Media Buzz contributes to The Hill, The Daily Caller, Town Hall, and you can find her articles at GailTrotter.com. This is a closer look at some of Gail's writings about the Trump cabinet. We'll take a closer look at more of that after the break. Don't go away.
New Year's resolutions. Losing weight? Reading more?
How about your spiritual resolutions for the new year?
Explain that one letter that you've changed.
Relevant Radio contributor Mary DeTouris Poust.
Instead of a resolution, let's go for a revolution, meaning a personal revolution. And I can sit there and look at all the things that would help my spiritual life. And I know if I transformed my spiritual life, it would transform everything else. It would transform my relationships. It would transform my family life, my work life, because my relationship with God would be the centerpiece, and that would transform everything. And I know that on an intellectual level, and yet that can be very difficult to put into daily practice. I thought I was going to try and do that on my own, and then I thought, no, I'm going to form a tribe instead.
You've done this on your blog.
I'm hoping that through this group we can kind of support each other and remind each other that that's the first piece that has to happen, and then the transformation comes from that.
Have you made any spiritual resolutions for the new year? This is Relevant Radio.
This week on Christopher Close Up, I'll be talking with one of the few people on Earth who have actually gone beyond the boundaries of this planet. Astronaut Mike Massimino will join me to discuss how he realized his childhood dreams of going to space and why that work gave him a more profound sense of God, heaven, and his Catholic faith. Join me, Tony Rossi, this Sunday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 3:30 p.m. Central for Christopher Close Up right here on Relevant Radio.
We have to get back on our knees. We have to pray.
Father Jim Sitchko.
And we have to trust. And if we're going to trust, it means we're going to have to be people of faith. We're going to have to get out of our comfort zone. We're going to have to be patient and realize that old things, all of these rhythms at times get disrupted, but we don't need to fear because God has never abandoned us. God is with us, and God will always be with us. And he makes it very clear.
This is Relevant Radio.
The Relevant Radio toll-free studio line is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. Information about their variety of life insurance options and annuity or retirement plans available at relevantradio.com. Keyword Forester. Welcome back to A Closer Look. I'm Sheila Logminas, taking a closer look with my guest, Gail Trotter, a Washington attorney and the CEO of the American Women's Alliance, a writer and commentator you've probably seen on Fox News and other television networks, and you've seen her work in print. Taking a look at some of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet members, and especially the military veterans, James Mattis, first and foremost, John Kelly, and Michael Flynn, who will serve as National Security Advisor. Their confirmation hearings, what we learned about them, and other cabinet nominees, what we've learned about them in the confirmation hearings versus what the media are saying about them. What a different cabinet this is going to be. So you've got the GailTrotter.com and all of the resources she's got there. I've got that posted on the show page today, both RelevantRadio.com and on my Facebook page. And if you hit that one on that landing page for the show, A Closer Look, please click share, so other people will be able to read this information as well. Because, Gail, we've got to go around that so-called gatekeeper media sometimes to pass this information on. So what do you think of how the confirmation hearings have been going on, what you think about how they've been going, and on other specific nominees besides these veterans of the military?
Yes, that's right. And I think that's why people love Donald Trump tweeting, because he is able to bypass the mainstream media, even on the hearings. I think the hearings are going well. I spoke with top Trump people this week, and they said that Donald Trump is so happy with his selections that he feels like the hearings are going very well. And you might have noticed that a lot of people criticized him for some of his selections when they're testifying before Congress, not necessarily towing the party line and repeating back exactly what Donald Trump said. And my understanding from insiders is that he's very happy about that. That's why he selected these people. He doesn't want yes men. He wants to have people who come in who are knowledgeable and wise and great at critical thinking and can give him good advice. He is not a black and white thinker. And I think when these hearings show that these selections that he has made are not just cookie cutters, that they don't just have a particular party line that they are promoting, but they really are concerned about what's in the best interest of America, it is reassuring.
It really is, and it's interesting how some of them are being grilled extra hard by the Senate confirmation hearing members. Some of the senators there are being particularly tough on some of them. And I find some of the lines of questioning just so politically oriented or so agenda or ideologically driven.
Right.
it's just so bald-faced, you know. But on these military veterans, again, yeah, I know there have been people who are very familiar with the way Donald Trump has handled business and what got him where he's gotten with to be such a success, and also with his Art of the Deal by saying that he reveals in the Art of the Deal. I have not read it, so I'm referring to the people who have said this, but they say that he reveals in there, as he has in interviews, that what he knows, and he knows it well, and that therefore he's very successful at what he knows, but he also knows what he doesn't know, and about that he goes out and finds and surrounds himself by, and this has been in the business world, the best minds on those topics that he needs to learn from, and that's what he's doing with his cabinet, is so goes the thinking on that.
That's right. And of course, when you say that, that reminds me of Donald Rumsfeld's famous quote about, we have known knowns, we have known unknowns, and we have unknown unknowns. And I think that is a mark of a good leader, to acknowledge their strengths and understand their weaknesses. And that's why a president has a cabinet. It's so that he can have a round table of people to advise him about areas that no human being, I mean, just think of how huge and complicated the federal government is, let alone trying to understand how to position America on the world stage and promote American interests while also promoting world peace and global stability. So, like you said, he has shown that he has expertise, and I think a big thing that Americans really care about after national security is the economy and jobs, and that crosses all racial lines, all socioeconomic lines. People want to have a robust and thriving economy so that they're able to provide for their families. And that's something that I believe President Donald Trump has the ability and the commitment to make happen for all Americans.
Well, he certainly has the business know-how. A lot of Rust Belt America and other states across the country that were overlooked or completely ignored by the big media. I don't call them mainstream, Gail, because I don't believe they are. And in fact, this election proved just that. Those people voted for him for jobs because they really believe that he will deliver on that and on tax breaks and on the economy and so forth. You've written about that. You've done other radio interviews. In brief, your thoughts on, because you've expressed them on your website and on radio before, Trump's tax plan, you think, is already starting to take effect, and he's making, you say, he will make America globally competitive again and is already showing how. How so? What about his tax plan do you think is already starting to take effect?
Right. I recommend everybody go read that piece on my website because I really dig into it. But to briefly explain it, the idea that America has the highest corporate tax rate of the 35 developed countries of the Organization of Economic Development and Cooperation, those are the top countries that you would think of when you think of the most successful countries in the world, we have the highest tax rate. So we have a 35% tax rate. And when we have American companies that see that they can transfer to Ireland, for example, which has a very similar culture to ours, but has a 12% tax rate, then that incentivizes those companies to keep the money offshore so that it's not able to be invested in innovation, jobs, facility development in the United States. And I make the point in this piece that before he's even taken the oath of office, Donald Trump has communicated to American businesses that this is going to change. We're not going to have the most oppressive tax system in the world. We're going to he wants to lower it down to 15%, which would still not be the lowest of the 35 countries, but it would put us in a state where we could have a lot of this company money that's held overseas brought back into the United States for investment in the American people. And that's one way that, for example, Ford, they were going to build a plant down in Mexico. Well, now they see that Donald Trump has been elected. He's going to change a lot of these regulations. He's going to make the tax code more fair and enable companies like Ford to actually be profitable if they stay in the United States. So he's already getting results before he's even set foot in the White House.
And he will be tomorrow at noon. Gail Trotter, thank you so much for your insights, for bringing those in here to discuss the military generals on his cabinet. And hopefully some of these appointees will be finally confirmed when he takes office. Gail Trotter, we'll talk again soon. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
I have actually been on Balance of Nature for a year now. I have MS, and I recently had an MRI. This is the first year that I've had a stable MRI, so I'm thrilled. When I have an MRI with MS, usually there are glowing spots that come through, which is damage on the nerves in my brain and my spinal cord. And when they're glowing, it means they're active. And then my last MRI, they pulled it up, and I honestly couldn't believe that it was my MRI. There was nothing glowing. And in fact, the dark spots were shrinking. They were healing. And the doctor actually said to me, I think we're in remission. I was so happy. I had no idea that that could be my reality.
The new challenge will allow you to receive 2 months of Balance of Nature's fruits and veggies free. And we'll even ship them to you free. Call now for details. Call 1-800-246-8751. Or go online to balanceofnature.com. Use promo code RELEVANT.
Relevant Radio contributor Monsignor Charles Pope.
Very often at the water cooler, oh, you're a Catholic? Oh, gosh, you don't really believe all that crazy stuff your church teaches you. Ah, you know how it is. And, you know, you just kind of brush it aside rather than stand there, look that person in the eye and say, yes, I believe these things. And I think our world is going to pay a very heavy price for the sins we're committing today. We've got to get back to God. But again, we have not done much. And priests need to start modeling this in the pulpit by teaching clarity, conviction with charity, but being willing to take a little bit of heat, even from their own congregation, you know. But teach it with love, courage, and with conviction. Model that, and then help others to learn. Likewise, in our catechesis, beautiful Catholic radio is helping people to do to get clear on their faith and to know what we teach and why we teach it and why it makes sense, and to have a joyful conviction that this is the truth.
Enlightening minds, inspiring hearts, enriching souls. Talk radio for Catholic life. Relevant Radio.
Giving voice to our shepherds. Relevant Radio. Archbishop Jerome Listecki.
What does it say? Go into the world and preach the gospel to the whole creation. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. An urgency to make sure that this message that is given to us of the love of God through Jesus Christ is offered to everyone. And maybe in our complacent society, where we take things for granted, we need to be more intentional about that, about who we are, what's been given to us, and the grace of taking that Jesus life seriously into our relationships that we encounter. Take that Christ into the world. Take that charge seriously and offer hope to a world that is lost.
Giving voice to our shepherds. Talk radio for Catholic life. Relevant Radio.
How does your day start? How about starting it with prayer? I can help. I'm Paul Sadek. Join me weekday mornings for Daybreak on Relevant Radio. We pray the office of readings and morning prayer, listen to the day's gospel, and get some inspiration from the Holy Father as well. It's right before morning air at 6 a.m. Eastern, at 5 a.m. Central, and in New York. Daybreak on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
The Inner Life with Chuck Neff. Our Catholic priests are here to help.
Maybe I need to trust more in this 2,000-year tradition of the Church and the way that great saints have wrestled with these same questions. And I have to be humble enough to say I don't see everything that God sees. I don't have a full understanding of His providence. So I think our doubts are a real invitation to grow in like a virtue of humility rather than in hardening our hearts in pride and saying, well, I know better.
The Inner Life, 12 p.m. Eastern, 11 Central on Relevant Radio.
We Welcome back to A Closer Look. I'm Sheila Logmanis. It's the eve of the inauguration. It's a major transition time in our nation. A lot of protests are going to happen, certainly. How about everybody just coming together and being unified for a change, no matter whether you like the person in the office or not, or voted for them or not? The office itself is bigger than the office holder. President Barack Obama, back when he was inaugurated, said, even if you didn't vote for me, I will be your president too. Well, we certainly saw that coming, while nobody saw this election result coming. Really, just about nobody. At least the big media completely, spectacularly missed what America was saying and doing all the way up until the announcements were made on election night, very, very late that night. Joining me to talk about that and how it got so spectacularly missed is Joel Pollack, senior editor-at-large and in-house counsel at Breitbart News. Prior to joining Breitbart, he was a Tea Party-backed Republican candidate for Congress in Illinois and a research fellow at the Hudson Institute focusing on human rights and international law, along with my friend over there, by the way, Nina Shea. Joel, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you on to talk about your book. So the book is How Trump Won, The Inside Story of a Revolution. What was the revolution?
Well, in a sense, it was a revolution in how politics is done. And he broke all the conventional rules about how to speak to the media, how to address rivals, how to organize and fund a campaign. Almost everything that Donald Trump did was different and something people had never seen before. So that in itself is a revolution, but probably the most profound change is the relationship between the candidate and the media, where normally candidates try to flatter the media. They try to win their favor in the hope that they'll produce favorable coverage. Republicans are much less adept at doing it because there are very few Republican friends in the mainstream media, the D.C. press corps in particular. But Donald Trump basically went over the heads of the mainstream media. He found alternative media sites that would carry his message, and he just used Twitter and social media and earned media. He would say things that would get him news coverage, and the news coverage acted as a better way of advertising his campaign than anything he could have paid for. So he really used a completely different strategy when it came to the media. And, I mean, you talked about people who were surprised at the result. I was definitely surprised when he won. I always knew he had a chance at winning, but I did think he would win the nomination. I also thought after about 3 or 4 months of his campaign that he was probably going to be the best candidate for the Republican Party in terms of having the chance of winning, because he seemed to be the only one who was really grappling with the challenge that the media present for any Republican candidate, that he was the only one willing to break the rules a little bit of how candidates deal with the media in order to get his message out. And the others really didn't. I mean, even though many of them had better conservative records than he did, and many of them had, well, all of them had more experience in public life than he did, in terms of, well, not the celebrity public life, but I suppose in public service, in political life.
Right.
And he, you know, when he spoke in Chicago, or was scheduled to speak in Chicago in the summer of 2016, and there was a riot that shut down speech.
Oh, yeah.
It was interesting that his three remaining rivals, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and John Kasich, all blamed him, which is exactly what the Democrats were doing and exactly what the media were doing, was blaming him for the riots. Whereas actually, it was an organized attempt to shut down his speech. And many of us looked at this and thought this was crazy, because what everybody should have done is, regardless of whether you agree with him or disagree with him, stand up for his right to speak and for the right of his supporters to hear him speak. And those were basically shut down by the Chicago Police Department, who declined to provide the kind of protection that it would have required to stop the potential rioters. And these were many people who were brought from left-wing organizations to the University of Illinois at Chicago precisely to shut down this event. And Trump understood the mood of the public was sick of political correctness. There was an irritation with the soft-pedaling around, whether it was radical Islam or around budgetary issues, whatever. You're not really allowed to speak the truth anymore. And Trump's campaign was one that tried to, at least, he didn't always get it right. It wasn't right about everything he said, but he said what he meant. And that was refreshing to people. And he understood that what voters were looking for was that kind of authenticity. You saw a little bit of it on the Democratic side with Bernie Sanders, where he came across as more of a real candidate, not because his ideas were any more well-grounded. In fact, many of his ideas are on cloud nine somewhere, but he genuinely believed them. And if you look back 30 or 40 years, the Bernie Sanders of today is pretty much the Bernie Sanders you had of the 60s and 70s. He had an authentic belief in what he professed to to want to do. And voters, I think, were looking for that and looking for a kind of leadership that was stronger. You know, in the midst of the financial crisis in 2008, when Obama really took the decisive lead in the campaign, he projected a kind of calm, and that was something I think the public was looking for then. What people are looking for now, I think, was a kind of strength and perseverance. And that was probably the best case for Trump, is that he never gave up, even when he seemed to be doing poorly, and even when he seemed to have made some bad decisions, he stuck through things. And that's part of the story we tell in the book.
You and your co-author, Larry Schweikert, who was on the program the other day because he has two books out at the same time, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the President's Part One, he was on to talk about that. But you and Larry Schweikert take a couple of different tasks in this book, and they're both complementary to each other. The book, folks, if you just tuned in, my guest is Joel Pollack. He's one of the co-authors of the book, How Trump Won, The Inside Story of a Revolution. And in Larry's case, Joel, tell us who the deplorables are, because he was one of those among the, as you say in your materials, amateur politicos called the deplorables, who'd been publishing shockingly accurate polls and predictions all along. Were the polls that Larry and others who worked with you on the book contributed to it, were they polls that were so different than what we were hearing in other big media reports on television, New York Times, Washington Post, you name it, that they were disregarded?
Well, some of the data that Larry had was proprietary. So he had polls that were done privately that weren't available through the media. So he had, in some cases, better polling data or polling that was done under different assumptions. There are two parts to the book, and they're interwoven. My part is a firsthand account of what it was like to be a journalist on the trail with Trump, meeting people he was meeting, going to the events he was staging. And Larry, who is an historian, tells the story of the election with a broader sweep, but also talks about what you mentioned, this group of volunteer data analysts who he basically helped put together. They call themselves the Renegade Deplorables after Hillary Clinton's infamous remark. And they included some people with a vast amount of quantitative knowledge from whatever else they did. There were a couple of political professionals, some pollsters, other people just from the sciences and other areas, and some who've chosen to remain anonymous. And there was other people who simply had sources in places that data could be obtained from. So there were people in a county government who understood about what was happening in voting in particular places to a very fine degree that looking at the election in a broad national sweep wouldn't have allowed you to have. So Larry and the Renegade Deplorables put together data that they fed every day to the Trump campaign. And that's one of the revelations in his part of the book, but it helped the Trump team calm down on election day, because the exit polls were very bad for Trump. It looked like he was going to lose, but the data that was coming in from Larry and others suggested that he was in a strong position to win.
It's interesting because even though he spent a long time holding off giving an actual press conference until just recently, he here and there on his, what do they call it, victory tour, when he would go thank the voters in different parts of the country who put him over the top, when he was giving some of those talks to some of those groups, I don't remember where, Wisconsin, Ohio, I just don't remember where it was, but he brought up how election night, his daughter Ivanka, I guess, wasn't in the room with him, called him and said, you know, Dad, it's not looking good. And he said that really surprised me, he told the gathered group, his supporters. He said, because that didn't make any sense to me. And now that you tell this story, it's coming out in your book, that he was getting fed by Larry Schweikert and the other so-called amateur politicos. I think they're pretty good pundits, myself, and pollsters. But he was getting fed very accurate information from on the ground that did tell him, even his own daughter Ivanka probably didn't have it right from what she was hearing in the news, whereas he had better information.
He had better information, and Larry says in the book they had to talk some of the Trump people off the ledge, because when you looked at the media reports and the exit polls, they did look pretty bad. And when I arrived at the Trump victory party that night to cover it, at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time, it was like a funeral. People were walking in, you know, everybody ordered drinks to begin the process of comforting each other, essentially, and then once people realized that the Florida panhandle was still voting and those numbers hadn't come in yet, people waited to see what happened. And when the Florida numbers flipped around and it was clear Trump had won Florida, then it was a different kind of party altogether.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, so talk about that, because Joel, you're part of the book. Unlike Larry's, he does the polling and polling data and feeding accurate data and analysis in key states to the Trump organization through election night. You, as you said earlier, you did the reporting in this book, and it's so anecdotal, so colorful, of the frenetic closing weeks of the campaign, exposing what your material on the book says is shocking behind-the-scenes behavior of the story-manipulating press. A couple of things jump out at me from that. One is behind-the-scenes behavior can probably be quite frenetic in any campaign, because that's just the way politics are, and that's the way campaigns are, and that's the way media behave. But in this one in particular, and the story manipulating press, for how long now have they manipulated the narrative, if you will, and the politicians all the way up to the highest offices in the land, manipulating the narrative? Whoever controls the narrative controls the ideas people in this country have about, you name the topic, about health care, about the Affordable Care Act, about any number of things in the news. If you control the narrative and give people a story, I know there have been times President Obama has said in the past, I just didn't tell the story well enough, you know, to sell this or that idea. It really is a storytelling thing. So talk about that shocking behind-the-scenes behavior you reveal from having been in the campaign behind the scenes. And that story-manipulating press, they just really didn't get it, did they, what was happening in this country?
Well, there's a limit to which I can talk about exactly what happened behind the scenes. You know, there's an agreement that things said on the press bus and the press plane were off the record. But in general, there was an approach, I think, where the media tended to agree with each other on everything. A kind of groupthink had set in.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't need to be on the press corps to see it. You could just look at the nightly news. You could look at social media. There was an idea that Trump had no chance, and therefore the amusement or the fun of the campaign wasn't talking to voters and figuring out what they were going to do and what motivated them, but it was predicting the next Trump gaffe and trying to determine within the number of days or hours when he would withdraw from the race. In fact, it's still going on. I mean, we had this dossier, whatever, that was released a couple of weeks ago, allegedly about Trump cavorting in Russia and whatever, and it turned out mm-hmm. to be, as far as we can tell anyway, a hoax. And yet, when it came out for a few hours, there were people in the media celebrating this is the end of Donald Trump. He's not going to be able to take office on January 20th. I mean, that's a continuation of this expectation that he's simply going to fail and fold. And the fact that he didn't, it became, I think, a very powerful argument for his presidency, that this is someone who doesn't pack up under pressure. So the media basically had written him off, and they mm-hmm. believed they had seen this before. Republicans who thought they were going to cross over and compete in Michigan. Mitt Romney thought that. John McCain thought that for a while. In fact, Sarah Palin's book, after that election, Going Rogue, refers to a phrase that was used in that about her potential decision to go to Michigan and campaign there, even when the campaign didn't want her to, because she felt there were votes in Michigan to get that the campaign was leaving on the table. So anyway, it's a really important time, I think, to look at how our media cover our candidates and whether there are different ways for journalists to cover a president like Trump, and also to look at how he's deciding to use the media. I mean, in some cases, these controversies help him and he stokes them for deliberate reasons. So I think there's going to be a kind of rethinking among many media professionals about how they relate to the president, and we'll see what comes of it. In some ways, it's a very exciting time for journalism, and in other ways, it's very challenging.
It's both. So staying on that for a moment, he right after the election and right after it sank in and the president was magnanimous in inviting him to the White House and having Mr. Obama and Mr. Trump meeting each other and Mr. Obama congratulating him and promising a smooth transition as President Bush gave President Obama, the incoming and the outgoing, he promised that smooth transition and so forth. So right after that, Joel, within that same week, I believe it was, all the way from the New York Times through some other big media, through even the Rolling Stone. I know Matt Taibbi at the Rolling Stone did this, and among others. they quickly said, we failed. We missed this. We didn't get this right. And it was a bit of an apologetic examination of their, I don't know, conscience and how they worked to let down their readers. And the New York Times promised not to do that again and to try to be, you know, better and more accountable for what they do and so forth. That seemed to last about a day or two. And then it seemed to me that all of a sudden the media turned on them again and went back to the way they were on the campaign trail.
Yes. Well, that's the continuing story, really, is that, in fact, in some cases, the switch happened in the course of the same day where the same journalist said, we've got to rethink what we're doing because we missed this story. And then later that evening, they were back to doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge for the media is really to remember what the core function of the media, particularly what is the core function of political journalism. And there was a theory floated during the election that journalists have a civic duty to stop bad people like Donald Trump from becoming president. And that's not quite right. And obviously, the consumers of media didn't think it was quite right because enough of them voted for Trump to make sure he won. So, and also, you know, Trump was able to play off of that opposition. The traveling press corps was sort of like the Washington Generals for Trump's Harlem Globetrotters. You know, he just went from place to place and he was beating up on them all the time. And their job, in a way, as part of this spectacle, was to lose every night. Even though perhaps they didn't want to, and some seem to resent it over time. But I think that there's, as you say, it's about fact gathering, it's about truth, and whether it means the administration is doing its job or it isn't doing its job, that's what journalists have to find, and that's ultimately what journalists really want to convey to their audience. It's what the reading, watching, and clicking public wants to be able to consume.
And speaking of the clicking public, how do you feel yourself, Joel, about soon-to-be President Trump, President-elect Trump, once he's in the White House, in the Oval Office, continuing to use Twitter to the degree that he has?
I think Twitter is very important to him because it allows him to express himself in an authentic way. It allows him to reach past the media and talk to people. And I think there's some more method than madness to his use of Twitter. I think people are worried about it because it seems erratic, but he actually uses messaging very effectively on Twitter. He's not always right, and sometimes he doesn't retweet the right people or whatever, but he's made it work for him, and I think he's going to stick with it.
It does seem that it's worked for him in that, I mean, one wishes, you know, somebody in that office wouldn't say some of the things he says. But on the other hand, it is interesting how he can entirely go around the big media. And it probably drives him crazy that he can, because no other politician, no matter how high in office they were, could do that before. I mean, maybe they were totally in the camp of some politicians and against others, but nobody's ever really been able to circumvent the media to the degree he has and can still, and go straight to the American people. And so it seems as if, since that's worked for him so well, he will continue to do that. Certainly set a precedent, but so will the presidency of Donald Trump in every other way.
Yes, it will. It's going to be interesting. And look, Inauguration Day is a chance for renewal. And all the negative feeling that people have, the boycotting, the divisions, the social media wars that seem to never end, all of that, in a sense, ought to be suspended. Maybe doesn't stop completely, but people have an opportunity to step back away from it for a few moments and watch the president take the oath of office. And you can watch that even if you don't support the president. And conservatives have had to do that for two terms in a row now until today. And it's a witnessing. You know, sometimes you sign contracts with people you don't agree with because you're binding them to something and they're agreeing to be bound. And that's what happens when the president takes the oath of office. So it's a moment of national witnessing and maybe a moment for renewing our democracy, I think. And it's a new world. Journalists have an opportunity to rethink what they do. Political parties have an opportunity to tackle questions that have been deferred for a long time. And I think that's something worth celebrating no matter how you feel about Donald Trump.
That's very well put, Joel. I mean, no matter how you feel about the president taking office, the office itself is bigger than the office holder. And it really is a time for national unity. No matter how people feel about that, it is our representative republic. It is our democracy. It is a freedom, a liberty, a right, a privilege to vote and to come together at this time and to celebrate what we, who and what we are. Last thing, you're part of the book. It's very much the behind the scenes, you know, on the campaign trail with the campaign and so forth, reporting with the media and how the media handled this. The subtitle of your book, the title is How Trump Won. My guest is Joel Pollack, one of the two authors of the book, How Trump Won. But the subtitle is The Inside Story of a Revolution. Do you, Joel, think his presidency, his administration, his policies going forward, do you think that will be a revolution? And will we see one, do you think, in the media? Or will it be probably, possibly 4 years of finding all fault with Trump?
Well, I think some will. But I had an opportunity to speak actually this evening with Bob Woodward of Watergate fame, and he had a more circumspect view. And I think there will be some journalists who do what they're supposed to do. I have enough confidence that there are at least some out there who will. And,
good.
You know, at Breitbart, that's what we're going to try to do. Obviously, as a conservative news website, we have a particular perspective, which we're going to try to uphold because our readers expect us to do that. But I think there will be some who continue to believe it's their duty to play an oppositional role. And look, there's a place for that. It's useful in some way, but it doesn't always make for good content, number one. And number two, you know, the truth shouldn't be covered up because it's good for the president when you don't like the president, and it's bad for, and, you know, conversely shouldn't be exaggerated when it's bad for the president because you don't like the president. I think this is a moment where there's going to be a lot of scrutiny among journalists of each other, and hopefully some self-reflection when all the dust settles.
Well, that's that, and I'm sure you're putting out that kind of writing at Breitbart, because that's a really good reminder to us, to the nation right now, of what we should be doing. The book, folks, it's really fascinating. It's How Trump Won, The Inside Story of a Revolution. And I'd love to have talked with you, Joel, as well about your other book. One of your other books. Don't Tell Me Words Don't Matter, How Rhetoric Won the 2008 Presidential Election. That would be interesting, but now we're in the election of 2016. And it really wasn't rhetoric, was it? This time it was, is there one word to replace rhetoric? How you know, X won the presidential election?
Maybe how Twitter won the...
There you go.
No.
There you go.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that, right, because it reached the American people directly. Joel Pollack, thank you so much for being here and for the book. It's really quite a great read. And how, if people wonder, how in the world did this happen? You know, President Donald Trump, a lot of people felt the same way on Inauguration Day in 2008 or 2009. President Barack Obama, yep, you do get there after the election, and the president-elect then wins and is Inauguration Day comes along and is now ready to take the Oval Office. So get used to it, President Donald Trump. Thank you, Joel, and
thank you.
Very well done on the book. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate you coming in today. Folks, I want to share some thoughts with you here before the end of the hour. We're coming up on that in a few minutes. But a couple of things. I had a guest on the program the other day, Rusty Reno from First Things Magazine, talking about the loss of peace, and we can't allow our country to have a loss of peace in that very contentious election and in the aftermath, the divisiveness that goes on with the promised protest this weekend, right? Well, we can't allow that loss of peace we can't allow ourselves to be a part of it. We can't allow that to even infiltrate our homes, our own communities, our relationships. Relationships are so important. And Rusty said this election indicates how deep the changes are in our society and in our political culture. Both parties, he said, are in a state of deep uncertainty about their own futures, of course. And so it forces people to do, as Joel Pollack just said, some introspection, some looking at ourselves. I like how he said this is a time for renewing our contract, right? This is the contract we have with each other. When you have a covenant, when you have a contract, as he said, people cannot like each other and have a contract with each other, but they sign it once they believe. That's one thing I wanted to share with you. This is a really good thought that he shared with us. Another thing is I just happened to tune in a commentary by Fox News' Neil Cavuto. I like him. He was on my program a while back. And a couple of his comments, we're free to not like our presidents. It's our own business, he said, but it's our country. And this peaceful transfer of power is what we're all about in this country. It's not so much about honoring the man who's assuming the office, but the office itself. And I thought that was a great thought. It's not so much about the president, but the presidency. It's about what unites the vast crowds who brave the Washington cold every 4 years to witness history, to see something historic, no matter who's being sworn in, just to be there, to feel it, to witness it, to be a part of it. Whether it's about whoever's entering the office holder is one thing, the office is higher than that. It's not just the House, he said, it's the White House. The institutions that define us are so much bigger than the passing occupants who come and go before us. And all of their rhetoric and all of the orations that come out of it, it's we have to give space to that and give space to each other. We're going to be covering the inauguration live tomorrow on Relevant Radio. Chuck Neff and I are going to be covering it live when the swearing-in takes place, with commentary, with the actual swearing-in ceremonies, before and after commentary. Tune into Relevant Radio all the way from morning air. I'll be on with John Harper through the end of the day, this show hour, A Closer Look, the Drew Mariani Show, all day long. We're going to be covering the inauguration. It's a time to come together, and it's a time to unite. I'll see you online.
With Sheila Logminas is a production of Relevant Radio. To access guest information and past shows, go to relevantradio.com, keyword Sheila.